Hi everyone and happy new year. This is a little bit of a different episode. My buddy Cody and I reflect back over the last few months. Cody sort of walked me through interviewing me about the birth and the circumstances surrounding our new baby Fletcher. And it was a little bit different for me. It was a little bit hard to process, and you will have to put up with sniffling and crying from me. Also, you will hear our baby and some of the beeping from his machines in the background. So it will be a little bit of a different episode, but we wanted to kick off the year with some storytelling. And we are still in the middle of this story, but I really believe that storytelling changes the world and opens up a lot of doors for conversation and healing. So I hope you guys enjoyed this conversation.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to this super special edition of Bonding Time. This is Cody, and I will be interviewing your usual host, Lou, tonight. I'm just going to kind of reflect on some things from this past year and things that have been going on in our world and in our lives personally. We'll get started here. We're recording here on New Year's Eve. Are you happy to be here, Lou?
I'm beside myself.
Good.
Thank you for hosting.
Well, do it again. This New Year's Eve looks a little different. It's very low key. We're just at our house. We're not like doing anything with friends. We're not doing anything special. So it's definitely different. But you know, this year has been different, and so I guess it's kind of par for the course. It's been unusual.
It's a quiet winter night.
It's a quiet winter night.
I like it.
How's your holiday season been, though? Did you have a good Christmas?
It's been exceptional.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's been a very different, something that is just out of the norm. And so, you know, I realize that we're not the only ones who have had sort of a different year, a challenging year in some ways, maybe a good year in other ways. But it's just been different. It's been weird. It's been off in a lot of ways. And we did a podcast, I think it was a few months ago.
Yeah.
Just kind of about our journey through this spring and summer, you know, looking for a house and just, you know, all that kind of stuff, kind of being in between and homeless for a while and all that. And that was an adventure for sure. Do you want to maybe kind of recap that at all?
Yeah, you can go back and listen to that episode. I think it's, I'll put the number in, but I think it's called The Story of Our Summer. And we really talked about what in my mind is so cute now that I thought, like, man, we started this spring with COVID and this crazy time, and we were also house shopping. So we ended up kind of like homeless and traveling and living in a trailer for a little bit while we got our house to go through. And man, oh, and in the middle of that, we found out I was pregnant.
Uh-huh.
So it was like this crazy adventure. And we thought, like, at the end of that episode, that like I was getting ready to have the baby in a few months, and that we had finally found our house. And that was the arc of kind of a crazy story. And we had landed on the other side.
Yeah.
So that was cute.
It was false.
It was false.
And we can get into that more in a minute, but
we were in the middle of our story.
Yeah. And we kind of had like most people probably, or a lot of people had like grand visions of how this year was going to go, like goals, like everyone does. I mean, it's going to be a great year, 2020. And it was weird to have so many extenuating circumstances outside of your control,
right,
that were affecting you. But the weird thing about this year is, like, with COVID, it affected everyone in the world, which is sort of, it's unprecedented, because we've never had, you know, there's things that maybe go on in our cities or our workplace or our community or our personal lives that affect us. But to have something that's so universal, it's weird that everyone kind of shared to some extent or another in the same sort of experience.
We're alone, but all in it together.
Yeah. And, you know, everyone's obviously experienced it in different ways in terms of how it's affected them. But it's not just that. Like, this year was just a weird year with, like, all the people who have died and, like, the different, like, the race riots, the election, like, although there's been a lot, like it's been quite a year to process. When you really reflect on the year, it's been a one for the history books for sure.
We've processed through a lot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But for us, kind of picking up where we left off from the last podcast, when we recorded that, you were pregnant and we were kind of just, you know, getting settled into our new house. And so do you want to kind of fill everyone in on what happened since then?
Yeah, well, most people know, but I had had a really complicated history of pregnancies like a long time ago. Our first obviously was a really intense, scary ordeal that ended with a demise of our baby. And that was our firstborn. And then our second son was also very high intensity with lots of bed rest and hospitalizations, and he made it here. And so that felt like scary. And then moving forward, we'd had our two daughters and they were relatively like normal pregnancies.
More or less.
Yeah. I never do pregnancy well, but we thought we were done. We found out we were having a surprise little COVID baby. Mm-hmm. We were delighted. But I think there's always that fear that lingers when you've experienced some real intense pregnancy symptoms or illnesses related to your pregnancy, that it could be like lurking and there could be loss again. And so that's kind of what happened. The baby had, they watched me pretty closely, and I had had like quite a few appointments that they kept checking my blood work and my blood pressure because I have a history of preeclampsia. And I had just the day before or 2 days before I ended up having our baby, I had a really good, successful doctor's appointment. They like reran all my blood work and they said like, oh, everything's looking really good. And that is usually the point, like with both of my pregnancies, that kind of went haywire.
At 28 weeks or so.
Right. Right around there is whenever things would usually get pretty bad for me. Like I'd start getting really sick. And I, inside myself, kind of felt some of those same symptoms. Like, it's hard to explain, but some of the same sicknesses and feelings that I'd had before. But I just sort of tried to like make note of it. I asked my doctor about it, but tried to like talk myself out of it too, because everything looked good on paper. So that's how we kind of went into our 28th week of pregnancy.
So to kind of go more in depth on that, like, he was born on October 10th.
Yeah.
His original due date was
December 29th.
Right. And we had planned on like having the scheduled C-section and like everything was going to be routine, and obviously it wasn't. So maybe do you want to explain more about like what happened the night he was born?
Right. Well, backing up a little bit, like I said, we had a very good doctor's appointment, and then it was our daughter Avonlea's birthday
on the night.
The night before.
Yeah.
But I think God just gave us a couple of days that were extremely peaceful. Like, they were just good days. And I kept,
yeah, her birthday was a fun day.
Yeah. Like, I commented to my cousin and she commented to me, like, and Cody, that like, gosh, these last few days have just been like the fullest and best days. And I think because we'd been moving, and then there's a lot of quarantine stuff going on. So when you get a reason to celebrate, it just felt like you can hang on to it and sink your teeth into it. Like, there's a few days where I just was like so appreciative of having our home and watching my kids play outside, and we had like birthday cake with my daughter, and then mm-hmm. it just felt like this gift of a few really, really good days.
Yeah.
And then so that next day it was raining really hard, and I was shopping with the kids and doing different stuff, and I kept feeling like pain, just really bad pain in my back, but it would mm-hmm. go away. And I thought I had hurt my back because I had lifted our daughter earlier, and I just thought like maybe I hurt my back. And so you got off work and, like I love to do, take a drive in the rain because it was raining. I love the rain. So we made tea and we loaded the kids up, and I might have put like a heat pack on my back or something, but I was like, let's just go for a really good drive. And it was super fun and mellow. The kids like listened to music and we drank our tea. We just took a really good drive. And we got home and the rain picked up. It was raining even harder. And that doesn't have anything to do with the story, but it was. I just remember. And our kids were like laying on the floor. I still have pictures of them because I took pictures. They were getting along super, super well, which is like a unicorn night. And they were like drawing and playing with stickers. And we put them to bed and I kept feeling super uncharacteristically like intensely peaceful, but also like something was wrong. Mm-hmm. Like I felt
you were definitely uncomfortable. You were in pain.
But like emotionally I felt really at peace, like mm-hmm. happy and contented and so thankful for our house. And mm-hmm. I just love that kind of weather, I guess. It put me in a really good mood.
Right.
And then we went to bed and I was reading a book for a podcast that we were recording the next day. Mm-hmm. And I remember I kept, like, you went to take a shower or something. I was reading, and I finally was like, you came back, and I was like, I don't feel good. I don't feel right.
I remember coming to bed, and you were, like, gritting your teeth, and you were, like, planking almost on the bed because you were, like, stiff and tense and, like, uncomfortable.
Well, when you came back, yeah, I said, like, I don't feel right. And mm-hmm. I thought, like, I didn't know what was going on. And then everything happened really fast. Mm-hmm. It still didn't occur to me to be afraid. I just thought, like, gosh, my back, it's really hurting. Mm-hmm. And so you were kind of like pushing on my back and talking to me. And all of a sudden, I didn't even realize, but I heard you like yelling. You were like, babe, woo, woo. And I had just gone really stiff and I couldn't catch my breath. I was breathing super hard.
I was telling you to breathe.
And yeah. You had called the hospital, I think, to ask them what was going on. And while you were talking to them, I realized like in an instant that I was like soaking wet. And I looked down and there was just blood pooling out from underneath me. Mm-hmm. And that all of a sudden it like... my mind went into gear. Like, I was just like,
yeah, that's true.
No,
you did. You like hopped up all of a sudden and you were like, let's go. Yeah. I was on the phone with the hospital when that happened because I was calling just to like ask them some questions, like, what's going on? What do you suggest? And I was on the phone with the nurse giving them like your birth date and that sort of thing to start talking to them. And that's when you just started like hemorrhaging blood.
So, the funny thing was, is I'm really not someone who's very in tune with my body. Like I can be having a good day, but like be in pain and not really realize it till really for a long time, or I'll feel sick and not really realize it. I just kind of go on about
like
my day.
Know the cause of it necessarily.
No, I don't like take time to assess. I'm trying to get better as I get older.
I'll teach you my ways.
But what I didn't realize is like it was a slow boil throughout the night that I was like, gosh, my back hurts. And by the time you like came back from your shower, I was like rolling with sweat and like couldn't breathe, but it still didn't occur. Like it just was like this weird thing that I didn't know what was happening to me because it had kind of been like building slowly. And then once I started bleeding, I was having full on horrible, horrible pain. It was like being shocked by an electric shock. Mm. And
so you're bleeding. What did you do?
I jumped up and I ran in the other room and I immediately started thinking like this baby doesn't have very long.
Yeah.
And I was only worried about the baby. So I called my cousin and the kids were asleep.
Right. This is like 10 o'clock at night.
Right. And she like was racing over to her house and I went outside and I just started, I was like out of my body. I was just like yelling and groaning and you were trying to run over and get the neighbors to come.
And they weren't home.
Be with our kids so that we could leave before my cousin got there and mm-hmm. they weren't home. And then I realized like I'm bleeding so hard I can barely like keep my eyes open, and I started fading in and out. So then we finally raced to the hospital, and I just remember not praying in a nice way. I was angry, like we should have, this is going to sound bad, but like we shouldn't have had another baby if we knew what our past was like. Like we knew that we had dangerous pregnancies, and I just started yelling at God. Do you remember that? I
was the just, car ride there was very intense.
It was crazy. Cody was screeching through traffic, going really fast, and I was just like, God, you save this baby right now. I was just yelling. And
that was an intense car ride.
So you told me about the car ride because you were as stressed as I've ever seen you.
Well, obviously things weren't okay. And I knew you were 28 weeks, which a pregnancy's 40 weeks. So you're super early and losing barely that much blood, weeks. Like obviously not okay. And we have a history, you know, so I know something's really wrong. I knew that we wanted to go to the St. Luke's downtown because I knew he would need to be in the NICU, the baby. If he had any kind of chance, and they have the best NICU in the whole state and in this region. And so, and we live, you know, in a normal drive, what is it, 10 minutes?
Yeah.
Like from that hospital. But I'm going like 70 miles an hour, like through town, driving there. I called 911 just to, my thought was when we left to tell 911, I'd already been on the phone with the nurse at the hospital. And so the hospital knew we were coming. Cause she said like, how soon can you be here? And so I was like, we can be there like in 10 minutes probably. So she's like, okay, we'll be ready for you. But I thought I'd call 911 just with the mindset of like, I'll let them know that I'm speeding and just give them a heads up. Well, backfired on me a little bit. Cause the 911 operator was trying to convince me to pull over and to stop and wait for an ambulance and tell me not, he was telling me not to speed. So I was trying to tell him. He didn't ask me a lot of questions. I think he just assumed a few things. I think he assumed you were full term. I didn't tell him. You know, I think he assumed a few things like that. But I didn't tell him.
Our friend was joking that you were like the only person who would call the police on yourself for speeding.
Which friend?
Lorianne.
I'm just kidding. Oh, yeah, that's fair. Well, I thought maybe they would like, I don't know, give me a pass escort? Or like, well, like maybe just be like, okay, let this guy in this car go. Mm-hmm. Like he's fine.
No, that makes sense. You were a hero.
I was trying to plan it out because I knew we didn't have time and I didn't want to get like fussed with like getting pulled over or something, you know? And I was like stopping at red lights to make sure there weren't other cars and then going, but like I was going fast and he tried to get me to stop. I ended up just hanging up on him because the guy was like yelling at me and I was like, he's not understanding the situation or the scope of it. Cause he was like, pull over at this fire station. And I was like, no, that's not going to do us any good, you know?
Yeah.
And it really wouldn't have because the baby didn't have any time. Like he didn't have the time to wait.
That was strange. When we got to the hospital, they just like were waiting for me and raced me back. And they realized how much I was bleeding because as soon as they wheeled me in, I bled so much all over the floor that they were just like, oh my gosh. And I took off running. And they hooked me up and the baby had a faint heartbeat for like a minute. Mm-hmm. And they were trying to get an IV started and they were trying to like catch the doctor up on what was going on and ask me questions. But I couldn't, I was like in and out and couldn't barely talk. Mm-hmm. So then the baby's heartbeat quits and my brain immediately goes from like just into self-protection mode because I realized like I've done this before, it's extremely painful, but I can do it again. I just thought like, okay, this is gonna be a journey, but I can't deal with it right now. I can't process this right now. I just have to live. And so I set that aside and thought I will be extremely sad about this later. And I started telling them like, I have three kids at home. They don't even know I'm gone. I have to live. Like you have to save me.
Yeah. You were telling them like, I have to be okay for my kids.
Yeah. Like I have to at least say goodbye to my kids. Uh-huh. And so I told them, I was just like, work as fast as you can and please save me. And at that point I just started fading really fast and quickly. And they raced me out of the room And just, I went out. I remember the last thing that was so strange was seeing Cody's face. And I realized I didn't tell him that I loved him or anything. And we left him behind. And I thought, I made peace with it. I saw these big doors. They were pushing me through. And I just really made peace with it. I took a breath and I thought, if this is the last thing I see, then I know I just have to resign myself and let go. I cannot control this. And I don't want the last thing that happens to me is for me to be afraid. So I just started letting myself breathe and I reached up and the anesthesiologist was running beside the bed and he was working on me and I just reached back and held his hand and I just started holding his hand and he looked down at me and I said I don't want to be alone and I don't want to be afraid. And then I just started I just went out and they kept trying to, it had been like a few minutes at that point and I knew there was no hope for the baby, but I just had to, in like a split second, relinquish my big kids are 7 and 5 and 4 year old. I just had to like relinquish their futures into God's hands. Just like, there's a lot of people that love my kids and that's just going to have to fill in the gaps. Mm-hmm. And so, it was peaceful, but it was such a strange experience. It's really strange to talk about now.
Mm-hmm. Well, it was traumatic, you know.
What was it like for you? Sorry, I'm
no, crying. I'll be sorry. It happened super fast. Like, you know, as soon as they really took a look at everything, they moved really quickly, which I'm grateful for. Like, it was really incredible how fast they made the decision to like, okay, we need to do this now.
Well, I know, and I couldn't breathe and I know my blood pressure was so high that they thought I was going to have a stroke. So I knew it wasn't just me bleeding. I knew something was really
wrong. Well, and they didn't mess around with like trying to, they didn't spend a bunch of time trying to like diagnose anything. Like they knew what was wrong very quickly. And the doctor, the hospitalist who was on staff, and I really made the quick decision like, okay, we're doing this now. And she asked for like verbal consent for me to do the C-section and give you the like the anesthesia or whatever. Mm-hmm. And then they rushed you off and I had to sit, I had to sit outside. And so I couldn't be with you for that whole time, that whole experience, which was super, super stressful. I mean, I sat, a nurse just pointed me at a chair in the hallway and told me to sit there. And so I had no idea what was going on with Lou or the baby. Last we knew the baby's, his heartbeat was weak or stopped completely. And Lou was losing blood. So I had no, they were obviously all completely focused on her, not worried about like updating me or anything. So I just was sitting in the hallway crying by myself. And I actually called Mackenzie. Because she was with our kids.
Mackenzie is our cousin.
Yeah. And because I knew she was awake, it was like late at night. I knew she was awake and she was at our house. So, and I needed someone to talk to. And I remember her asking me if everything was okay. And I said, no, or I don't know, or something like that. And I just started crying. And so it was really scary, like a scary, very scary few hours, because I didn't know if Lou was going to live. I didn't know if the baby was going to live. I thought the baby most likely wasn't going to live. So I just was like praying that Lou was going to be okay. We'd been down this road before of having a stillbirth. And it was at the same hospital, the same, 28 weeks gestation. Everything was kind of the same in that regard. And so I just thought like, this is it. This is happening again to us, you know. Right when I was talking to her, a nurse said, come with me. And so like they took me back to this other room where a neonatologist and a respiratory therapist and a nurse were getting a bed ready for the baby. And they had a chair in the room and they told me just to sit and they were just kind of quietly getting it ready. And a nurse came in and said, you know, she's under, meaning Lou, and will have a baby here in just a few minutes. And so they had gotten Lou to sleep. And a few minutes later, a nurse came running in with Fletcher, our baby, in a sheet. And they got him on the table. And I was just sitting in the chair watching the doctor and the team work on the baby. And they were calm. They were very focused and very intentional. But I was just sobbing because, you know, when they got him on the table, he didn't have a heartbeat. And then they got his heartbeat. It was like 60 beats per minute, which is incredibly low for a newborn baby. Anyway, super stressful. And it was like 18 minutes and 34 seconds. They had a counter on the bed. They got him stable. They got him to like, they got him intubated. So he was on a ventilator. He was 2 pounds, just barely over 2 pounds. And they got his heartbeat up, you know, in the 140s and got him stable. And which was just a miracle. They kind of revived him and got him intubated, which got him kind of going and got him. He was in his little NICU, like incubator bed. They put like a bag around him at first to keep him warm, I guess. And then, yeah, the doctor just talked with me, but he was the neonatologist. So he was only 100% focused on the baby and didn't know anything about Lou. And so I asked him, he kind of briefed me on real quick, like what was going to happen with the baby. Hey, we're going to take him to the NICU. You know, you guys will have to have a negative COVID test before you can come see him. We're going to take him down there. If you have a negative test, then we'll see you in a few hours probably. And I was like, well, what about my wife? How is my wife doing? And he's like, oh, I don't know. I mean, he's like, I just would assume that if you don't hear anything, then she's okay. But I literally was in the room after that. They left and took him to the NICU. And I sat in this room by myself for 2 hours after that, and just waited and waited and waited and didn't have any word on how Lou was doing until they finally brought her in. And that was a pretty crazy experience because she was asleep when they brought her in. And they told me that she had lost 3 liters of blood and she had a PICC line in her neck and it was a crazy experience. So at that point, you know, it was the middle of the night now and just really no idea of like what was going to happen with Lou or the baby, if the baby was going to be okay long-term or what was going to happen. And we had no real answers. And when Lou woke up, she woke up and I had known the baby was at least alive at that point, and she did not because she went to sleep hearing that he didn't have a heartbeat. And so she had resigned herself to the fact that the baby was gone and dead. And so she woke up in a haze and just was asking, you know, is he alive? Is he alive? And she was asking it over and over again. You probably asked a dozen times, is he alive? Is he alive? And I kept telling you, he's alive. He's alive. And you just started bawling. And so we both just started bawling in the room. I remember our nurse, it was a male nurse named Brian, and he was like the greatest nurse. And super rare to have a male nurse in labor and delivery, but he was like the sweetest guy. We were just like emotional messes. And he was there all night with us, just kind of helping us out. And he kept things really just nice and lighthearted. And, but it was crazy because when Lou woke up, I've been through some crazy stuff with Lou. I've never seen her in so much pain. I mean, just the absolute pain and agony she was in, from physical pain from the C-section because it was so urgent and they didn't have time to properly give her the anesthesia like they normally would, or the pain medication like they normally would. And so they started cutting into her before she was even asleep. So anyways, it was insane to see just how much agony and pain she was in. But I mean, how, from that point, from waking up for you, because you go to sleep, what was your last memory when they put you to sleep that you have right before you went to sleep?
Like I said, just holding that guy's hand and just trying to talk myself up for whatever happened. And when I woke up, it was like from the the most hard and most peaceful sleep I've been in a really long time. It's like you can tell you're a mom of a bunch of little kids if you're so tired that surgery feels like a really nice nap. But I was like, man, that was the deepest sleep I've ever been in. But I remember immediately seeing you and being so surprised and relieved. Like, I made it. Oh, my gosh. Yeah. And all I wanted to know was if he was alive or not. And you told me that he was. And I was just, like, flabbergasted. I could not believe that he had made it. And I couldn't believe I made it. So I was pretty euphoric. And then it just crashed in on me that, like, I was shaking in pain. I was in so much pain. And so they were trying to catch up to it with morphine and painkillers. And once we kind of got the pain to, you know, I don't know, at bay for a little bit, I was really disconnected. Like, because they had kind of told me that the baby was alive, but just try and enjoy some time with him because he was, you know, without oxygen or heartbeat for a long time. And he was really struggling. So they were like, you know, there's no guarantees and he's probably not going to make it. Just enjoy some time with him. And I remember feeling like super disconnected, super peaceful, and just like pleasantly surprised. And then looking at you and you were kind of wrecked and sad.
Well, yeah, they hit you with all this information of like what they're worried about, what they think is likely to have happened, like brain bleeding and all this kind of stuff.
Yeah, like even if he made it, they really expected a lot of major trouble, and especially within that first 2 days. And so you were pretty wrecked, and I was so out of it from that point on. That my brain, I felt confused. I felt like hallucinating a lot. Like when doctors and nurses were in and out, I was like I was hallucinating a lot. And I felt confused. Like they would talk to me and I felt like they were talking in other languages. And so that started making me feel afraid. Like I was like, I'm super glad the baby's okay. And I kept just trying to talk to myself and be like, you made it, baby made it. But I just was really confused, really disoriented, and really afraid because I didn't know what was happening. Mm-hmm. But I kept looking at you and saying, like, why are you crying? And you would re-explain and be like, I'm really sad.
It was so traumatic, yeah.
And I would be like, okay, yeah, why are you crying? And so they finally took us to see the baby, and I remember I was hallucinating at that point too, and it just seemed like everything was floating. And
I remember you being really impressed by my Apple Watch. You were like, dead serious. You're like, where did you get that? Did you buy it at Target? And you were like, super impressed. I was like, well, I've had it for a year.
I knew like outside my body, like you're not thinking right. This isn't, you're not processing, but I just couldn't. So then it was just weird. It began, I stayed in the hospital for a while, and it began this journey of me still being really confused, really weak, and I really missed my kids. I was worried about the baby, but I was just a total mess, and I couldn't sleep, and I kept having this fear. And this is where, I don't know, God has brought me through a long journey the last couple months since this has happened, because I don't know how much is like demonic, how much is just like being really exhausted and tripped out. But sleep was
definitely a factor.
Yeah. Sleep became really hard and strange because I just felt like I'll probably die if I fall asleep. So I can't sleep. And so I just didn't sleep. And didn't sleep and didn't sleep. And sometimes
that was right after he was born.
Yeah. And sometimes they would in the hospital knock me out with like
all the drugs.
Really intense dose of something to make me sleep. And I would.
Oh, you were on morphine.
Yeah.
And something else.
No, they gave me like a sleeping thing. They didn't want me to go home on it because they said I could like way overdose on it. But they would knock me out and I'd finally sleep. But it was not restful or peaceful. It was
forced,
confused, enforced, and fearful. So you were great. You kept dividing your time between the baby, the big kids at home, and me. And when you were gone, I would kind of get like confused and afraid and forget where you had gone. So I would start being like,
yeah,
I'm alone. And where did he go? And I'd get really afraid. And then you'd come back and you were great. You'd like play quiet, peaceful piano music for me. And you'd read to me.
It was selfish for me. Yeah.
You're like, I want you to sleep. But you would leave again to go see the baby and go see the kids. And at first I'd be like, yeah, go see the baby, go see the kids. And then I'd sit there for a few
by
minutes
yourself
and forget where you'd gone. And I'd be like, yeah, I'm alone. Where is everyone? And then I'd get really afraid again.
Yeah. That's what was also just like one of the really challenging aspects of it. Cause normally when you have a baby in the hospital, the baby's in the room with you. Well, with him, he was in the NICU and you were in postpartum. You know, and they were taking care of you still. So you were still a patient in the hospital and he was a patient in separate rooms. But because of COVID, nobody could come visit you, only me. And it wasn't like we could trade off one at a time or something. It was only me that could come see you. So no family, no friends could come see you, which mm-hmm. was super hard because you were in there for almost a week. And then afterwards, and then you and I couldn't go see the baby together because of COVID.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was hard too. So the only day we saw him together was the day he was born. And from then on, we couldn't ever visit him. And you were so out of it at that point.
Yeah, I couldn't really
you were in a wheelchair
go up there very much. They didn't want me to leave. But that's kind of a stopping point for one of the main things I wanted to talk about. Because in that last podcast where we talked about our summer of searching for a house and being sick with pregnancy, I talked about how hard it was for me to like receive kindness from our community. Like I'd rather be giving it than receiving it. And this just upped the game like crazy because that whole week, as I came to and as I became less confused, like I can't even talk about this without crying because our people in our community like gathered outside the hospital and prayed for the baby when he was really touch and go and not gonna make it. And he pulled through and like people drove, you know, from like Oregon, and then our friends here like took care of our kids, dropped stuff off for our kids, and took care of you, would bring food to the hospital. Yeah. Also, like a few of my friends posted up outside my hospital room window
signs,
and they made these like beautiful signs.
Yeah. Oh my gosh, we could talk for 2 hours.
I know
how much, you know.
I know, and it was crazy because it was so confused and disoriented. But then I would have these moments of clarity of like soaking in just this beautiful generosity and love and encouragement from people, and it was almost confusing. Like, why are they so kind?
Yeah.
Like, I can't.
No, people were so generous and so kind on so many different levels. Not like just really practical ways. I mean, from groceries to cash to just praying for us to giving us gifts to encouraging us to whatever. You know, I mean, they're just like the list goes on and on. Everything you could imagine. And it is like you said. Like I remember, I've just felt like we don't deserve this. Like we're so blessed by all these amazing friends.
Well,
you know?
And it's like a direct, whether people are like believe the same as us or not, they still showed up for us, whether they, you know, love God or not. They, all of our friends and family showed up, and it would be this give and take for me because I would get, I mean, this last year, loneliness has been like this really intense prevailing emotion, I guess, for everyone in the world.
Yeah.
But this really intensified it because I was very confused and alone a lot because you were gone a lot.
Yeah.
And so I would go back and forth between having these nightmares and being really alone. And every time I would wake up and or come to, and it would be like, hey, someone left this at the front desk for you, or someone dropped this off for you, or look out your window.
Yeah.
There's people standing out there like praying for you, or they would call me, friends would just call me. And so it was like this direct result, this give and take, where I would be like spiraling and be like, I'm alone. I'm totally alone. And then I'd be like, I'm not alone. Look at these people showing up and like loving me and basically being the hands and feet of
Jesus
yeah.
to me and our kids. And that was amazing to watch. Like, I desperately missed and worried about our kids because they just went to sleep one night and woke up to, like, all this chaos. And the way people loved our kids for me was really amazing. And the way people prayed for me, because I was in a place I couldn't pray. I still am having a hard time, like, putting thoughts together and praying. It's like people are interceding on our behalf and Fletcher's half behalf. And that is something that will always mean the world to me, I think.
So he was born late on a Saturday night. He was born at 11:04 on Saturday.
Yeah.
And that next day, that Sunday afternoon, our friends had gathered a bunch of people to pray. And it was like at 4:30. And I was so tired and so overwhelmed emotionally and just so drained. I didn't even want to go because I just like didn't want to have to talk to anyone because I just felt like I couldn't even mutter the words. And I am so glad that I did. And I just went down and they came to the hospital outside the doors of the hospital at St. Luke's. And I don't know, there's probably 20 people there maybe. Mm-hmm. And some family from Oregon and then a bunch of our friends. And they were just there, you know, they were just there. They didn't obviously expect anything of me. They just prayed for us. They prayed for you. They prayed for Fletcher. And I remember Robert Frazier being like, does he have a name? And I was like, Fletcher. I was like, all right. So that was like when we decided like what his name was going to be. And everyone started praying for Fletcher at that moment. And it was really powerful. I'm so glad because I was like, I don't know if I have like the energy to even go down there to pray or to talk to anyone.
Yeah.
And I was so grateful that I did because it encouraged me so much. And it just was encouraging to know like, this is like the body of Christ. And this is like the way that Jesus wants us to just show up for people.
Right.
And be there for people when they're really just going through something hard and in just a practical way. In a loving way, just being there, mm-hmm. physically being present and willing to just come and just say like, hey, I'm praying for you. I'm here for you.
Right.
And we had so many friends do that. And it was overwhelming to me and made me feel like really loved, really cared for by our community of people that mm-hmm. we have. And even convicted me because it made me feel like, am I doing this? Like, am I doing this how I should be for people? Yeah. In the same capacity, you know, maybe sometimes, probably not as much as I should, you know.
Yeah.
But it's been crazy and it's been a blessing. And
so the official thing that happened to me was called an acute or total placental abruption.
Acute placental abruption.
And I had heard of it before. It happens
in less than 1% of pregnancies.
Right. But when it happens, it's almost always fatal for the baby and you a lot of the time really bad for the mom. And once I learned more about that, I began this strange give and take with fear, and which is not always in my personality. A lot of the time I feel optimistic or pretty sure that things are going to work out. And I started just feeling like, gosh, if this doesn't happen very often, then why does it happen to me? And feeling really afraid, but then feeling hope because as everyone prayed for him, he kept making it through the night when they didn't think he would, or they would say, we're pretty sure he has some severe brain bleeds, and then he would miraculously not.
Mm-hmm.
Or they would think he was going to have a seizure and then he wouldn't. And yeah. People just kept praying and praying. And so I've had this strange give and take with keep your guard up.
Well, they present it in a way to where you do keep your guard up because everything is glass half empty.
Right, right. Which is smart of them. But like right. With me too, just I think healing from disappointment and hurt in the past is just to kind of keep your guard up.
Callous.
Yeah, and not hope for too much. But then once but also like letting yourself kind of abandon that and like feed off of other people's hope and prayerfulness for you. Uh-huh. It's just a really strange, I'm probably rambling about it, but it's a really strange back and forth for me to always be processing. I still am just like really hopeful, picking up that positivity and momentum, but also being like, things can go wrong in a second and it doesn't matter who you are. So like having kind of this trauma and fear that started bleeding over into not just about the baby, but about my other kids. I started having like debilitating fear over my big kids at home or even my friends.
Like if they'd get in an accident.
Yeah. And so that's been this really interesting response within myself that I have to kind of go outside of my body and and talk to myself. Like,
yeah,
it's okay to be hopeful and to live and not just go into conservation mode of trying to keep everyone alive and safe.
Yeah. Yeah. At what point do you feel like you really realized the scope of what had happened?
Probably right now.
Yeah. I mean, we're only 3 months away. Yeah. I mean, so maybe we haven't even, maybe you haven't even, I don't know. But I know, like you had said, like you were on so much medication and drugs at first. It was kind of like a haze. And also there's like sort of a trauma response of like just surviving, you know, trying to just get through each day.
Well, what had happened as well is I ended up coming home and I was so happy to see the kids. It was very hard to leave the baby there and things with him were still really up in the air. And I started having these horrible headaches, which were partly a response to some medicine I had, partly just, I think, just trauma. I started having horrible headaches and confusion. Every day was getting worse where I was really confused. And then I started not being able to read or put together sentences very well. Yeah. And that was really discouraging and fearful because I didn't want to go back to the hospital or have anything wrong with me. But I do have this motivation of like, I have to be healthy for my kids, so I have to make sure things are okay with me. So they adjusted my medication and also ended up kind of just telling me that my brain was fragmenting psychologically from stress and lack of sleep, I guess, and trauma. And that has come and gone. I'm definitely so much more solid, but I've just been... if I don't take care of my mental health, I do end up feeling this really strange disassociated feeling of like confusion and not recognizing anything. And I've had to like fight my way back. Like, don't go to sleep on your life. Don't let yourself check out. Like, right. You have to fight and feel all of these feelings and fears. So it's been a really interesting thing to kind of like be outside of my body, watching that happen, watching how your brain responds, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, that's interesting. And this, like, I think we both really wanted to, neither of us really knew necessarily how to be or how to respond, but we also wanted to just be sort of proactive, you know, in terms of like finding help, accessing resources, trying to just take steps forward.
Because
when we had our stillbirth, we handled it wrong in every aspect.
We didn't acknowledge anything.
We were immature and emotionally in our relationship. We didn't know what to do or how to be, and it really hurt our marriage and affected our marriage. And so this time
and our mental health, we didn't acknowledge anything. So I think we both purposed like, we don't know what to do, but we are going
to
do something.
Yeah. So I was like making phone calls to people. I was trying to like take steps forward and like be proactive.
And being really transparent with our community.
Yeah.
When people would ask you how you're doing,
yeah,
they're probably sorry they ask, but just being like,
I know,
not great, not doing good, or this is what's going on, instead of, you know, like 10 years ago when our first son, like even at his service, it was just like, doing good, God is good, feeling pretty good about things.
And everyone's like, great. That's
okay. Great. Cool. So I think that we
can tell that you're not.
It was very full circle and very both. We just know, we knew, like, we don't know what to do, but we know what not to do.
Right.
Because if we're going to be messy, we're going to be messy together. And we're going to, like, let ourselves
process,
feel and this, and, like, let the waves pound and wash over us. Yeah. And, that's exactly what it's been. Like you, like we don't have to do anything. We just have to stand still and let the waves wash over us of life. And this knowledge that's all culminated with, like, you know, the election and all this unrest in our country and all this stuff. And then in the middle of our life stuff that's going on, is just letting these waves wash over you of knowing and acknowledging, like, I am not in control of any of this. Like, I'm powerless, except for in these micro, small ways that I can influence my sphere, and I can reach out for help, and I can reach out to help people. And that's, like, I think probably the bravest thing I've ever done, and I hope to still do, is, like, stand still and not check out into all these different roads I could let myself go down.
Yeah. I just was thinking about that day after he was born. Your friend Amanda and your sister Summer came over, and I had lunch with them. But I, like, basically we didn't have that much time. Like, I told them the wrong restaurant and, like, didn't have that much time. And so when they, I was waiting for them, and I had to get back up to be with you because you had, like, someone was coming to talk to us in your room or something like that.
And you didn't trust me to process the information?
Not even close. No, so I only had, like, 10 minutes to visit with Amanda and Summer before I had to walk back up to the hospital, which the restaurant was across the street from the hospital, so
yeah,
it was right there. But they went to the one in Meridian instead of the one in Boise. So anyway, for, like, 10 minutes, they were like, okay, like, how are you? And I was like, I'm not good. I'm not good, and like, told them the story. And I remember I can see both of their faces, just like their eyes wide and like, oh my gosh. Like, and I was like, I was crying, and told them I, like, wasn't okay. Told them the whole story. And then I was like, okay guys, I gotta go. And they both are just like, what just happened? They're like, oh, okay. Like, bye.
And I think we'll learn to, like, balance that a little bit.
Yeah. Well, and ideally I would have had a little more time to talk to him, but I was like, I'm not okay. And just, like, spilled my guts. And then I was like, okay, see you guys later. Oh gosh. I probably have a few friends out there that are avoiding me for a while. They're like, I don't want to talk to
Cody. They can handle it.
So kind of past that initial trauma and shock of what happened, from your perspective, what was it like just kind of day in and day out of the experience in the NICU, going to visit him in the NICU? What was that like?
Yeah, one thing I've learned about my brain, I think I heard Brene Brown say this, is that you, like, the brain is trained to, like, think in an arc of a story. So you want a beginning, a middle, and an end.
Mm-hmm.
And this has been a really strange brain break for me because and anyone who's had, like, someone with chronic illness or a NICU baby, that it just doesn't ever end. Even after the initial shock wears off and life goes back to normal, it does end. But it has felt like, oh my gosh, like, it, like, settled on me. I came home and then it just started settling in on me. Like, this isn't even close to being resolved. Mm-hmm. This isn't even close to being over. And so accepting help has been really important. Just like so many times I would just want to be like, okay, I can figure this out. And I just really couldn't. So I had to let, you know, my mom or a couple of close friends like balance my big kids while I went back and forth. And I think the thing that I've craved the most is rhythms. And I didn't realize how important they were to me. So I think with each phase of this thing, I've tried to kind of scramble to find a rhythm in a day. Like, okay, I'll go up in the morning, then I'll do this with the kids, and then I'll go back up.
Right.
And once I could find that cadence and kind of work those kind of rhythms out, I would feel sane. Like, okay, all I can do is show up at these certain times and do my best.
Right.
And it was hard because it seemed like Fletcher would have a couple of really good days and then he would tank. And that was really close together at first, where he would do well and then he would just be critical and tanking. And then they would get him back and he would do well. And so I became really strange. It was like my senses were overloaded. So I would go up to the NICU with like a hood, sunglasses, and earphones in. And if I could have like swaddled myself, I would have. But I couldn't handle all the noise.
I could have swaddled you. You should have asked me.
I should have. Sorry. Next time.
I'm sorry.
All the noise, all the beeping, all the stuff kind of started making this really intense like response in me. It sounds dramatic. I didn't do anything outwardly, but inward, I just felt like I would disassociate really hard and like get really confused and have like a migraine. And so I just started figuring out little hacks for my own body. Like sometimes I'd wear sunglasses in there, and I always had like my earphones in just to cut the noise, take the edge off a little bit. And so I could sit back and watch them work on him on really bad days.
Well, to give context to that, when he was first born on a ventilator, in the first, month he was on a ventilator or so, give or take.
Mm-hmm.
And he was in basically like an incubator to control the humidity and his body temperature and everything. We couldn't just go and pick him up.
No.
I mean, we couldn't, and most days we couldn't hold him, you know, usually we could hold him like once a week for the most part, because it was such a big deal to even move him. And so going to visit him was more just like standing next to his bed.
Yeah.
It wasn't like we could hold him. You couldn't like rub him with your hands. There's too much stimulation and not good for his skin.
Sometimes they'd have him in the dark. And
yeah.
So I think for that back to that feeling of like the lack of control and helplessness was really hard for me to make friends with. But I started realizing like, this is what it is. Like I'm really thankful for these amazing people that are able to sustain his life. But motherhood right now doesn't look like how I feel like it should. All my instincts are like to do all these things for a new baby and hold it. And I could like stand in the corner with like my sunglasses on and watch them work on him while he would crash. And so I just kind of had to find coping skills and stay flexible. And just, I knew how much it meant to me that the people, whenever I was really sick, were like, back to what we were talking about earlier, that just showed up and were there, even if they didn't know what to do. And so that's what I just determined I was going to be for this baby, is like, I don't have any skills to do anything for him, but I'll just be present in Emmanuel and standing next to him. And you and I would take turns doing that, and then trying to do that for our big kids too.
Yeah,
because they were kind of like in a tailspin. The emotions were running really high at home because everyone was a little scared. When I first got home, if I wasn't at the hospital, I was just sacked out sleeping, and my son would just post up. He was so worried that I was going to leave again or that I was sick. He would just post up next to me in my bed, and he would color. He would listen to audiobooks, and he would just sit and build Legos, but he would not leave our room. So we kind of learned a lot about that gift of just being in like a helpless, messy state, but being next to each other. And letting that be enough. And I think it's underrated more than
more than you'd think, because I'm so much more of like, gosh, I got to figure out what to do. So that's been inspiring. I tried to like, it like one day really helped me shake out of my funk to look around and see these other helpless moms. And some of them up in the NICU did not have a support system like we had. And you could just see exhaustion and fear on their faces. And so I just really tried to be like, who am I to like receive all this from other people and then not give it? And some days I really couldn't. Like, I just had to show up and be like weirdo in the corner with my hood and sunglasses. And other days I really did try and be like next to them and listen to them and ask them about their lives and their babies. And it kind of forms a pretty deep bond with some of them because, mm-hmm. you know, they're going through something really unique mm-hmm. too. So I think that was a gift. It really showed me. I'm someone that's like, well, if I don't know the right way to show up for someone, I'll just kind of stay out of their way and be quiet. And I've been really shaken out of that. Like, that's not who you can be anymore. Like, you have to give life no matter where you go. Mm-hmm. So that was something that was really cool. Halfway through, man, there's been so many different things. We can't just go on and on and on about it. But halfway right. through this journey, like right before he was coming home.
Spoiler alert.
Yeah, I mean, he's home. But I think there was so much shame, and I really don't know why.
I think, shame for what?
I don't know. I'm still trying to figure it out. Like, that my body didn't do a good job. I'm not sure, but yeah. I kept every night like that I could sleep. I would get home from the NICU and I would go to sleep. And I kept having these like reoccurring nightmares of like these just people showing up and watching me. Mm. And they would always come up to me at some point, say the same thing, which is, you did this to yourself and in a really mean way. And the weight of the heaviness of just that shame would almost crush me, and I'd wake up in total cold sweat. Mm-hmm. And this last few months has been just a battle and a fight for that, to undo that lie in me of that I think goes a lot deeper than this experience. But just to like somewhere along the way, I kind of made bargains with things that weren't true. And
what do you mean by that?
Just agreeing to believe lies that like mm-hmm. somehow I could have changed the outcome or
sure. What do you think was driving that narrative?
I don't know. I wish I knew. I'm still working it out. Like,
yeah.
I think there's just a lot of pressure on moms
yeah.
to get their kids here safely.
The NICU too, there's a general feeling of inadequacy because you can't always be there. So yeah. when you're home, you need to be home with your kids and your family, and you at some level, like, you have to continue to function.
Yeah.
But you also feel guilty for not being there because yeah. he's alone. And so it's like this, just, it's almost shaming in that sense of like,
yeah.
I can't be there with him all the time.
Yeah.
And, but when you're there, then you're not home. You're not with yeah. your other kids, and you're not with, you know.
Right.
So it's, definitely was a really challenging like dichotomy that we had to try to yeah. figure out. And I don't know, like, if there's a right way to do it. You know, I don't know.
Right. Well, and I think that's unlocked a ton of freedom in me. Once I like recognize that, it almost made me mad. Like, I'm not going to be subject to this voice and listen to this voice.
Yeah.
And realize I'm not enough to be everything I need to be for everyone and myself. And it's literally making me almost lose my mind. So letting...
What helped you get to that point, to that realization?
I don't know. I think the gift of this whole experience has been some clarity. Like, okay. Some of those things have been so ugly that it's probably been brewing for years, mm-hmm. and years beyond this. Probably since 10 years ago, since we lost our first baby. Mm. And it just came so full circle that it was almost like I stared it straight in the face, and I still am. And it just, like, no, I'm not going to accept that. And as I do that, it's been causing me to, like, let go of a ton of control, and realize, like, I'm the illusion that I've had control or could cover all of this or prevent any of this stuff from happening was just an illusion. And so I kind of have to free fall and, like, give up, like, let other people step in and love us and love our family and give yeah. over some of the control. And I've just watched God come through every single time I do that and just show up in the weirdest ways, financially, putting our Christmas together, ministering to my kids. But the hard thing is it's just been me having to give up and humble myself and be like, I'm not enough. I can't do all this. And it turned shame into, like, fresh air and freedom. Mm-hmm. And I know I'm just rambling because I can't really put words around it yet, but that's been the gift that's coming out of it, and a gift of freedom. And we're in the messiest part because now he came home and he has, da-da-da-da. Yeah, he's here. You probably have heard his whining and little beeps from his machine.
So he spent 67 days in the NICU?
Something like that, yeah.
And he came home before his actual due date, which was a surprise.
Yeah, so they had told us he wouldn't come home till, like, late January, and he actually got to come home the week mm-hmm. of Christmas, mm-hmm. which was just, like, such a miracle. He is fragile. He has oxygen because he has a lot of scarring on his lungs. He has a heart monitor, but he is extremely strong and he's a delight. He just doesn't sleep very much, so I'm
at least not when we need to. Well, it's not like having a regular newborn. He's very high needs, like, very high demand. He needs, like, full-time care,
right? And so that's been the theme that I keep having to, like, just let go of, is just, like, how can I be everything for him? And how can I also take care of my kids and love them well? How can I be a person and a human mm-hmm. and not just a shell of a tired person? And I'm still in the middle of that. And I know this isn't forever. I know that, you know, he's going to grow and our kids are going to grow, right. But I don't want to just glaze over it until it's easier. I want to kind of live into and lean into these feelings that I'm having of mm-hmm. like, I can't just be so homesick for everything to go back to normal and, like, find our normal again. Like,
need a new normal.
We got to make a new normal. And I have to just, like, let go of a lot of these things that I think that I can be everything for everyone. And, like, really letting God and mm-hmm. other people fill in those gaps, has been really freeing for me, but it's also been really humbling. And just letting myself be loved, because I'm watching myself love this helpless baby, right. and he's not able to give a lot back. And then realizing, like, well, in the bigger picture, I'm a broken, high needs right. baby, and I'm letting myself be loved. So,
what do you think the most challenging or difficult part of the whole experience has been so far?
I think the longness of it, it's like a marathon. So just kind of a chronic tiredness.
Ultra marathon.
Which, and then that, just like the mind, the crazy mind, the fear and the inadequacies and the lies that we tell ourselves,
right.
Which has also been some of the richness, because we've taking time to stare some of that down and, like,
it's forced a lot of reflection.
Yeah. And we've really sat with our kids and mm-hmm. then also been, like, just waves and waves of mercy for other people
right.
too, that have kind of crashed around me is realizing like everyone, no one is immune from these moments in life that force you to like stare things in the face, and everyone is just doing, a lot of people are doing the best they can, and a lot of people have been really hurt and broken, and so trying to like see other people and show up for them has actually been really healing.
And I kind of alluded to it earlier with him, like when talking to the doctors and nurses, a lot of times it's glass half empty, you know, where it's like, we're excited if he meets a milestone, but it's usually met with like, well, you know, doesn't mean that it can happen still. Doesn't mean that he couldn't be blind. It doesn't mean that he won't have this or that his brain won't bleed.
Right. Well, and they're not bad people.
They're not. And that's just the reality. But I think that's part of the challenge with it, is there's never any closure of like, he's better now.
Yeah.
It's this perpetual ongoing thing of like, well, we'll see. Well, yeah. We'll see. Well, we just don't know yet.
I think you and I are facing down the hard work of hope. Like hoping is the harder path, but I think that it's crucial, and it's what I want my kids to learn too.
Yeah.
It's just some childlike hope through this Christmas time. It was kind of like what we needed.
And genuine hope needs to be like the long game, the long-term focus.
Yeah.
Of what we have. Okay. Anything else you want to say about Fletcher or your experience with Fletcher?
He's amazing. He's amazing. Yeah. His life has impacted us a lot.
Guys, thank you for listening to this story and putting up with my sniffing and my weepiness. It means a lot to have you just listen and be a part of it. My hope is for anyone who's feeling inadequate and overwhelmed and just crushed with the weight of life, that they would know that they're not alone and that there's hope and they can put one foot in front of the other. Please reach out to me if you'd like to talk any further. And we cannot wait to tell more stories and have more conversations in the new year to come. Happy 2021.